In addition to this question of political legitimation, there's also the issue of social imperialism. That the new wave of imperialism was a means of diverting attention away from domestic problems. Ferry, in fact, had said, and I quote, social peace depends upon outlets, close quote. In Germany, after 1873 and elsewhere on the continent, with the downturn in the economy, and also with a growing social problem, that is the growth of a large blue-collar urban working class, it was necessary to find ways of diverting attention away from thorny domestic problems. One of the ways to do that, and do it in a way on the cheap, was easy foreign policy successes, which could no longer be gained at home. That is no longer be gained in Europe. So some sort of colonial policy, some sort of imperialist policy suggested itself. In this regard, Germany, France, even Russia involved in China would suggest themselves as candidates for this particular explanation. Certainly these are considerations in colonial policy there. There were also strategic considerations. We've already talked about the need for raw materials, the desire to ensure access to those raw materials. For Great Britain, maintaining the route to India was seen as of being of paramount importance, to maintain routes around the Cape or through the Suez Canal, India being, as we've seen, the jewel and the crown of the British Empire. This also meant, and all of these considerations actually would contribute to, a growing sense in Europe that in the future, real political and economic power was going to depend on the Navy, on naval power. The ability to project national interests beyond Europe and to think on a global scale. One sees in the 1890s then a growing interest, one could almost say obsession, with naval power, even from a country like Germany, which had traditionally had very little in the way of a naval presence. So, political legitimation, social imperialism it was called, diverting attention away from domestic problems, strategic considerations, particularly in the British case, all contributed in the 1880s and 1890s to this renewed wave of European imperialism. But there were also cultural factors that were very prominent in this period as well. Cultural factors that all have a longer continuity than perhaps others. Here one sees this period of Europe, of enormous European ethnocentrism, that Europe was the center of civilization on this planet, that European technology, European power, all underscored that superiority and that claim to rule. As a consequence, Europeans traveled out into Africa, into Asia, and elsewhere, absolutely confident and convinced of their civilizing mission, that they were going to bring the benefits of Western civilization to the rest of the globe. One sees it not only in an economic, technological sense, but also the sort of missionary role of bringing Christianity to the non-Western world. Dr. David Livingstone, who was certainly a very prominent man in British imperialism, would talk about Christianity, commerce, and civilization as being the main driving forces behind European imperialism. One wag suggested that instead of Christianity, commerce, and civilization, it might have been put more succinctly as God, gold, and glory as the driving forces. There was also at this time this sense, of course, of social Darwinism, a kind of crude survival of the fittest and a hierarchy of civilizations and races. We'll talk about this in a subsequent lecture. But certainly Rudyard Kipling, the British poet with such works as The White Man's Burden, All of these things played a role. The sense, this absolute confidence of the Europeans that what they were doing was not only made economic sense, military sense, strategic sense, but also was morally justified in establishing their superiority around the world.